accession number 27083, reel 22.
I think you've just got one or two more remarks just to finish off the mine sweeping before I raise a question with you.
Well, I've really finished my describing my time in FIS. It was 18 months. It was, apart from the very sad incident of being turned down by my my beloved, it was an extremely happy and a very rewarding time in terms of human relations, in terms of practical seamanship and professionalism, and with a super lot of people. But the time had come, and my new appointment came through, and I was to go back to Whale Island to be in charge of the Gunner School, which I will describe further in a moment.
When you're sweeping mainly Italian and German mines, did the Italian and Germans now provide you with charts of what they had done, or were you always or largely sweeping blind?
A bit of each, really. The general areas were, and they were, I think they were probably entirely German mines, but I may be wrong on that. We certainly had information on the general areas. I think that was as far as we trusted them. And so you applied a bit of a margin on the limits of any one field and so on. And you had to conduct your affairs so that all the ships were in swept water. And so when you started a new field, you, first of all, in swept water, you sent the danners along, danlers, to lay a series of dan buoys on which the leader of the squadron, of the minesweepers themselves, would then navigate. And you had to be very careful about this because each standby had a string of pellets, and depending on how the danboy itself lay in relation to the pellets, so it indicated whether for tidal or other reasons there was a send one way or another. And you had to be very careful that you never steered the ship into possibly mined water. And that was for the first lap. And then the remainder of the squadron followed astern in quarter line, as it were, and the end of each individual ship's sweep had a buoy on it, a kite, so-called, and that acted as a marker for station-keeping purposes for the next astern, and so on down the line. inevitably, the eight ships in the squadron covered a relatively short, narrow distance in terms of a single sweep. And you then had a not particularly complicated, but it had to be a very precise maneuver to come out of one lap, as it was called, and get back in such a way that the ships which had been in quarter line one way were now disposed in quarter line the other way for the reverse course. And that required reasonably precise ship handling, and of course with practice this came quite easily, but it was important to get it right. And if you got it wrong, then you strayed into a field and then you were in real danger of blowing up. And these ships, the sweepers themselves, were so constructed that they had dual accommodation. And when you were actually sweeping, you used and only used the upper mess decks. At other times, you could use all mess decks. And to that extent, accommodation for those times was very good indeed, because it was effectively double.
Yes, and you messed above the waterline so that everyone could jump off, I assume.
Yes, exactly that. Well, not so much about jumping off as not being blown up, you hoped.
Yes. And did that happen? Were ships lost?
Because not in my experience. Oh, yes, it had been known. And it certainly happened during the war.
No, this is why I asked the question, because we're now 5 years,
yep.
6 years after the end of the war, and still the Navy is busy clearing up mines in the Aegean and no doubt elsewhere.
Yes.
It does seem as if it's an enormous... So in other words, the merchant navies of the world presumably carried charts of where they can and can't go. And whole areas of the sea must have been, of certain seas, must have been off limits.
Indeed, they certainly were then.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what the position is now. And come to that, of course, the same goes for the battlefields of North Africa,
yes,
with landmines.
They're still there, are they?
I think there are a number still there, yes.
But you didn't lose any ships?
No.
Were they made of wood in any way at all?
No. No, they weren't.
So you had no protection against...
Magnetic mines. Yes, you had degaussing and all that. But there were, I think I'm right in saying, there were no magnetic mines in the Mediterranean. I think they were confined to home waters. I may be wrong in saying that, but we had magnetic sweeps too, but in my time we didn't use them. They weren't there sort of it. So to that extent we thought we knew what we were in for. The extent to which we really knew, I'm afraid I'm unclear of.
Okay. Thank you. So off you go back to the UK, back to Whale Island again.
That's right. To what was termed the Gunner's School. It was a plum job, and there were three categories of classes that I was the boss of. The first and the most important were the so-called fire control gunners, old term dagger gunners. These were highly selected gunners of some seniority and of particularly selected intellectual ability. If you did not have that intellectual ability, you remained at a lower level as just a gunner, in which you did a very responsible job and you were in charge of the ammunition. But it was the fire control gunners that were in charge of the computer rooms and so forth. So the fire control gunners at the top, and they required your personal attention, your personal instruction for practically everything they did, and it was very time consuming, and I forget exactly how long the course lasted, but it was something of the order of 9 months. And that was the first thing, very personal, very time consuming. Then below them were one or two classes of, probably one, of gunners qualifying. These were petty officers and chief petty officers in the main who were qualifying to become officers, warrant officers. they had their own officer instructor who was a fire control gunner, a dagger gunner, and probably an assistant. But you were the ultimate boss. And then there were, at any one time, there were probably two, sometimes even three, classes of gunnery instructors qualifying, and these were petty officers who were probably first-class gunnery rates, but not yet instructors. And they did a that's part of a six-month course. And you were in charge of the whole of that entity, that school, and that's where the buck stopped, as it were. The time I went there, I had a fourth job, which was school's liaison, and don't ask me why, this was a fait accompli the time I got there. We were responsible at Whale Island for looking after Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire. Why those two counties, I don't know, but that was it. And we were charged, I was charged, it was a one-man band, and I was charged with visiting and lecturing and, if you like it, advertising the Navy. That's the basics of what it was, and the Navy was the last in this field. To the prep schools, the secondary moderns, the secondary techs, the grammars, but not the public schools. In fact, I poached from time to time. The public schools were dealt with by a commander known as the Admiralty Lecturer, and he went round. It was a much easier job because you had a much more receptive audience, and so on. I will come on to that later on in some detail. It was interesting, and one used to go off three times a year, fortnight at a time. You had to do everything yourself. You had to call on the headmasters to fix a date for the following term or whatever, and then turn up and then do it. And then in the evenings, because all the schools packed up at 4 o'clock or so, in the evenings, although this was not part of our terms of reference, I used to go along to the local sea cadet unit and spend a couple of hours with them. And that didn't do any harm either. But to come back to Whale Island and the Gunner School, I was faced with a twofold problem, really. The first was that I realized quite quickly that the standard, both of practical instruction and of, if you like it, professional gunnery, had to be quite high, very high, in fact. And they really needed you whole time. And preparation of lectures, which were to quite an advanced intellectual level, was very time-consuming. At the same time, I was conscious that the standard of fairly newly qualified gunnery instructors, not the gunners, the gunnery instructors, the petty officers and so forth, had slipped. And it was no longer what it had been. And whereas in the past, and in my memory, it had been just about as taught as it could be, it no longer was. And that was evident to me. The gunners qualifying presented no problem. These were sterling men. I don't want to appear casual about them. They were very important men. They did a very important job. But they had got to where they were by sheer good sense, experience, salt of the earth, characters and so forth, and so on. And so they still were. So my main problem was how to match the requirement for personal instruction of the fire control gunners and sharpening up the gunnery instructors qualifying. And I did a bit of a hatchet man stuff, and I assembled all the gunnery officers qualifying and said that I was not satisfied with their standards, and that at the end of their course They would, of course, have to qualify academically, so to speak. And then, in order to qualify, unless I was prepared to have them, each one individually, in my ship as my gunnery instructor, he would not qualify. And this was not terribly happily received, as you might suppose. But it was an honest statement, and they had fair warning of it. Well, there were, I forget how many, not very many, two or three quite patent misfits. They shouldn't have been there, really, but they'd slipped through the net. And I sacked them. I knew this would have an effect, and it had, and it was a very salutary one. And they pulled their fingers out after that. And I only had to do it once. And
when you sack someone, do you effectively post them? Right?
Yes. So they went back to being an ordinary, whatever the probably first-class gunnery rate had been, but they were not a gunnery instructor. And I did this, this is an aside, really, and it gave me immense pleasure, ultimately. There was a little man, his name was Harvey, and he just wasn't up to it. He wouldn't say boo to a goose. He appeared to have very little character. He was short, tough, stocky, and so forth. Mentally not bright. And he wasn't up to snuff. And I had to sack him. And sometime later, when I went to the previous Newcastle, the cruiser, as her gunnery officer, I found that Petty Officer Harvey was one of the captains of Tops. This is Sod's Law, you might say. And we recognized each other. He bore no grudge. I mean, he was an honest man, and I think he knew that he wasn't up to it, had done at the time. And when I first re-met him, I asked him how he was getting on, and he seemed much more full of himself, much more self-confident and so forth. And I told him straight out, I said, that nothing would give me greater pleasure than if, in the course of my time in Newcastle, I could recommend him, Harvey, to go back and qualify as a gunnery instructor. And I can't remember at what stage I learned all this, but I learned, I suppose it was in Newcastle, not only had he left the GI's queue, but shortly afterwards he'd left the Navy. And he lived up north somewhere, and he was married, can't remember about the family. And he tried this, and he tried that, and he tried the other, and he couldn't find a job. And he, this went on over a period of, some months anyway. And he eventually got a job with a scrap merchant. And his job was to be taken to wherever, quite early in the morning at 6:30 or so. And he was provided with a sledgehammer. And he broke up scrap until quite late in the evening, 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. And he was a little man. He was tough, but he was a little man. And at the end of whatever it was, 6 months or even 12 of this, he was absolutely exhausted. And of course he was getting nowhere. But he was just scraping enough together to keep his wife. And so forth. And suddenly one day he thought, well, why don't I go back into the Navy? And he did. And before my time in Newcastle was out, I'm glad to report that I was able to recommend him for gunnery instructor. And this time he passed.
Good.
So it was a happy ending one. But he brought it on himself in that by sheer guts he fought his way through his bad times, and I think he was lucky to get away with it. He deserved it every time. However, that's rather sidetracked me. At the end of my first year, and so that was really the end of my first fire control gunner's course, I thought, well, you know, this isn't right. It's inefficient. And although I was prepared to go on for as long as I could stand it, it was really too much. And the work in preparing lectures and delivering them and supervising the fire control gunners and supervising and keeping a close finger on the pulse of the others was simply not on, and it wasn't efficient. And so I wrote this down, without mincing my words, in a report to the training commander, who by then had become my senior long course, had been my senior long course instructor. And so he knew me pretty well, and he knew that I wasn't going to bull about it. And I said, you know, I will go on for as long as I can, but it is not efficient, and I'm not sure quite how long that's going to be. And the net result was, and he moved quite quickly on this, he realized that really it was time the fire control gunners became a full-time job, and he got another chap from my long course to come in as whole-time instructor for them, so I was relieved of them. And I'll turn now, I think I really said this largely, how I was charged with school's liaison. My predecessor, who'd also been in charge of the gunner school, my predecessor had never done any school's liaison. This is telling tales out of school, and so I won't mention his name. But he used to book out, as it were, for a fortnight a term, but he never went near the schools. And he, you know, in season he'd poke off to Goodwood or whatever, and it wasn't really the right way to do it. So I was faced with a backlog of some 2 years in school's liaison, which was another way of saying that nothing had been booked in for me when I took over, and you somehow had to do a double take initially in order to get the thing back on the rails. And I used to go round by car. You had to, really, for local towing and freighing. I would call, in term one, I would call on the headmasters, chat them up, tell them what I was up to, and so on, and make a date, hopefully, to come back the following term with a fixed date and give my lecture. And my lecture visit took the form of arriving, hopefully to be met by the headmaster, taken into whichever bit of the school, which might be the whole school or any bits of it, that he ordained, speak to them for about 20 minutes. Makes me blush to think of it now, but a rather sort of boasted up there I was from the war years, and so on, followed by a very good film about the Navy in war and so forth for another 20 minutes or so, followed finally by 20 minutes or so of questions, which might be anything on the sun. I took round with me one of my excellent chief gunner instructors, and he ran the film and the cinema and all that. And I drove about, I had a fairly high-powered car. I had an Allard in those days, and I scared the living daylights out of my chief GI, I think. But it got me round quite fast. And then when the school's packed up in the evening, you might for an hour or so, be able to pitch in on another headmaster to make a date for the following term, and or one went off because they usually mustered about 5 or 6 in the evening, and I visited, which was not part of my remit, a sea cadet unit if, as was often the case, there was one in the vicinity. And thereby hang other tales, which I think I can come on to in a moment. It worked out very well. It was a complete eye-opener to me. And I'll give you a few examples. I went to a school in Bedfordshire, just outside Bedford itself. The headmaster had been headmaster pretty well since the war. And I'm talking now of 52. When he had taken over, he found that the school was a shambles. It had been totally let go during the war. And he, when he took over as headmaster, he determined to bring it up to snuff. And he started, quite rightly, he started with the staff. And he told the staff that they must wear a jacket and trousers and a collar and tie. And this was the it was the area of the headquarters of the London Brick Company. And it was quite a well-to-do area in a way, but they had a rough edge to themselves. Well, one or two of the staff complained, and he said, well, either do it or go. So they did it. And then he started in on the boys. And he said, he went on, same sort of lines, you know, you wear a tie when you come to school. Or else don't bother to come to school because you weren't acceptable. And he got several rebels who just declined to come to school. And the rebel boys were backed up by rebel parents who said, how dare you behave like this towards my little Johnny, and so forth. And he merely placed his feet firmly in the ground and stood it. And said, if you wish to have your boy educated in my school, you've got to comply with my my regulations. Otherwise, you can go elsewhere. I don't mind. And after a bit of a hiccup, and quite a nasty one, I got all this from him direct. The boys complied, and back they came to school. And furthermore, the parents started to comply, and when they visited the school or came to collect, they put on a tie and that sort of thing. Now, you may say that wearing a tie or not is not the be-all and end-all, but it was a question, again, of standards, and he pulled them right up. And that was good. He was a nice man, and I had an easy time there, and that was it. Top of the pops, you know, real success story. In a different vein, I called on a headmaster in, I forget whether it was Hertfordshire or Bedfordshire, it doesn't really matter. And the headmaster was a pacifist, and he didn't approve of anything to do with the services. And although I cajoled and tried to argue him out of it, I realized ultimately that I was getting nowhere. And I never even got into that school. And that was interesting because the effect that he had on the young, and the buzz must have got round if anybody told you to other schools and so forth, but there it was. And then I can remember exactly which school it was now. I went to the Secondary Modern in Bishop Stortford. It stuck in my mind because I'd been through all the things, and I'd called the headmaster previously and so forth, fixed the date, gone there. And it was my first lecture of the day. And it was due to kick off at 9 o'clock, I suppose. And I arrived at about 8:30, because one had to meet the headmaster, one had to give the chief GI time to set up the cinema and be ready for the film, because no delay when you're on site and so forth. And so I arrived at 8:30, and nobody at all met me. And eventually I waylaid an unlikely-looking member of the staff and asked to be shown to the common room. I think I asked to be shown to the headmaster's study first, and I was told he wasn't in or something. So then I went to the common room. And very much in due course, some member of the staff, fielded me from the common room and took me to a lecture room where all the boys were gathered and where my chief GI had set up the film and so on. And it was, he hardly almost pushed me into the room when he left and shut the door behind him. I slightly wondered what I was in for, and it quickly became apparent. And the back row, the whole of the back row, which were the older ones, were lights. And